Thank you very much to all of you here in the Purdue University Northwest coming in for this forum to talk about a very, very important issue, one that seems to be changing almost daily now, as we are just probably days away from finding out what the latest word from the White House will be concerning immigration matters, in particular whether we see another a replacement executive order for the one that is now being contested in the court system. We have some great people to talk about it here. We have, starting out here on the panel, we have Purdue University Northwest Associate Professor of Political Science, Frank Kaluki. And then next to him here at the table, we have one of his colleagues on the Political Science Department faculty, Assistant Professor Yu Ouyang. Thank you for being here, sir.
Good to be here.
And next to me, we have a Northwest Indiana attorney and a Purdue University Calumet. Now, of course, he's Purdue University Northwest graduate, an alumnus, Alfredo Estrada. He's with the firm of Burke Costanza and Carberry, and he is also the co-chair of his law firm's immigration practice group. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start the discussion here with, I guess, maybe a history lesson. We were talking before the program began about the importance of immigration matters here in Northwest Indiana. It's, of course, always been said that the United States is a nation of immigrants, and no place more important probably is here in Northwest Indiana in particular. The Northwest Indiana business climate was created by immigrants, people who came perhaps initially at least from Europe coming here to support the mills and the other factories here in the region, and that has changed, of course, over the years, but it's still a very, very important issue to talk about here. I'll leave it to you, Frank, if you want to talk a little bit about your feeling is about the importance of immigration here in the region.
I think basically this region really receptive to immigration. There are lots of people coming in every year, both in Northwest Indiana and the greater Chicago area. And I think that's why you may see a little bit of a different view about potential changes in immigration policy here than you might have in other parts of the country.
Professor Ouyang, you've had a chance to meet with your colleagues and pick up some of the flavor of Northwest Indiana with your time here here on the Hammond campus. And your own personal experiences here, what do you feel about how history plays a role in the immigration issues?
Well, not just history, but also the diversity of our student body here, that where a good portion of them do come from an immigrant background. So I think sort of the current political environment that we have in the United States right now makes not just our region but also our campus very similar to most areas around the U.S. and that is there is a climate of uncertainty and also a climate of fear.
Mr. Estrada, what are your thoughts being a member of the community here? Having lived here, having worked in the mills, as you mentioned earlier, to basically help put yourself through Purdue University Calumet at the time, and now you're out here as an attorney and practicing and helping represent people that are immigrants.
Just within my practice, in being one of the few Latino lawyers who practice in immigration law within the community, it's evident of the fear and uncertainty there is here, but particularly, it's a personal issue to me because I'm first generation. And my father came here undocumented, and my mother was born in El Paso. And so the region is built up upon immigration, whether it's Irish or Polish or Serbian, Croat, within cities like East Chicago, Hammond. And now a different influx coming in present day. So. But it does extend, in my mind, the region's not so different than the rest of the country in that manner, just maybe a bit more recent. Mm-hmm. So,
Professor Kaluki, since you have more specialty is constitutional legalities, would you find that we're kind of at a crossroads, perhaps, in dealing with this issue of immigration in particular and how it stands with the definition in general, as well as how it fits into the U.S. Constitution?
Yeah, I think so. Although I think it's fair to say that just about any time that a president and Congress want to change immigration policy, particularly a president wants to change immigration policy on its own, there's going to be a lot of legal and constitutional disputes, whether brought by individuals or even brought by states within the country that have different views. As we know, the current travel ban executive order from President Trump was challenged by the state of Washington on behalf of its universities in its state. And to get the ban initially stayed. But even if you just look in a past administration, for example, with President Obama's immigration orders, those were challenged by states like Texas and Arizona who wanted to pursue their own policies as well. So I think one thing you can say about immigration, at least from a legal and constitutional view, is that certainly it's going to bring up these disputes. And you'll have often these disputes come from areas of the country that may be ones where the president's generally not popular, or areas that may have a different view of immigration policy than the president has.
Professor Yang, since you focus in on the power of the presidency, we're seeing, of course, most of the attention and publicity these days coming from the White House. If you will set us a historical tone, going from one administration to the newest one, where do we see the changes that have happened, that in your opinion, that we're facing today? And I suppose, you know, of course, it's gone back in history now. We go from the Obama administration now into the Trump administration.
Well, historically, the executive branch overall, as well as the office of the presidency, has grown increasingly more powerful over time. And one significant part of that, why that's the case, is largely due to how much we're now expecting the president to now accomplish and to do for the nation. In terms of comparing across administrations, if we're just focusing on these executive orders type actions and sort of compare where the current Trump administration is to the past. So just for comparison, as of today, President Trump has issued a total of 15 executive orders since he was sworn in, and as a comparison point, by the same date of his administration, Obama has issued 16, George W. Bush has issued 7, Clinton 6, George H.W. Bush 2, and Ronald Reagan 9. So I think in terms of sheer activity, Trump administration in some ways has been more active than a lot of his predecessors, but really just as active as Obama was when he first got in.
Mr. Strada, as an attorney here in Northwest Indiana, what do you see as the impact that the of course, of not only the Constitution, but the presidency is having on the face of immigration reform as it seems to be within the new administration right now? And how do you think that's affecting Northwest Indiana residents?
Well, and so particularly the newest one, that was not the Trump ban, but the February 20th one concerning the security of the nation and the reprioritizing the removable classifications from immigrants or undocumented who were here January 1. 2013 and after as being priority removals and criminal offenders to particularly focus on this new definition of what a criminal act is, such as, so he's prioritized removals based upon criminal acts, those who are charged with criminal acts, and those who have may have committed acts that may be criminal. And this redefinition of what priority is has created fear, because under the INA, Section 275, being here undocumented is a punishable by incarceration. So it makes every undocumented person here removable, at least in a priority removal within his new executive order. So that alone has caused a different tone of how people live their lives. It's been an uptick in my practice and seeing different scenarios that I'd never envisioned representing individuals on to come into the office and seek advice.
Professor Colucci, looking at the Constitution, and looking, as we know, the history of immigration. It's changed, of course, over the years of the centuries, actually, from the 20th into our century now. What are you seeing as the impact with the changes here that have happened recently, as well as what you may see with this executive order that will come up here, hopefully, very soon? We'll know better.
Okay. One thing that we definitely see with immigration, and Professor Wu Yang will talk about this, I think, a bit more later when he talks about executive orders. The reality is that immigration law and immigration policy under the Constitution is set by Congress. It's an Article I power. That's something that should be set by our elected officials in Congress through law. That said, historically, immigration law has provided, in some ways because of necessity, you can't cover every case, has provided a lot of discretion for the executive branch, who enforces the law, about how they're going to enforce immigration law and what priorities they're going to set as to, particularly in immigration, who's going to be given what status while they're here, what categories of people who are perhaps here illegally, what is the priority for deportation, how many resources will be used for deportation. So the reality is that under our system, Congress ultimately has the authority, but as we've seen over the last couple of presidencies, Congress has really not passed any sort of comprehensive or anything close to comprehensive immigration reform. Really, the last major one, I think, was actually under the Clinton administration in 1996. So the reality is that Congress is a bit bogged down and can't come to an agreement. The laws that we do have are necessarily broad and provide a lot of discretion. So if it provides a lot of discretion, different presidents with different priorities can enforce the same law slightly differently. And that's why we have, both from a major executive order from the Obama administration in 2014, granting legal status or deferred action to children and parents who are here, but a different administration, a different president, a different executive can have different priorities.
Professor Yang, talking about that presidential deference, to be able to change the rules, so to speak, as he chooses fit, and we see that with the change of administrations, what are your thoughts that we're going to see here now if we do come up with a revised executive order very soon?
Well, as Frank mentioned, mm-hmm. The Constitution gives Congress the authority to make laws with respect to our national immigration policies, but yes, it is up to the executive branch to enforce. And as a result, enforcement and enforcement priorities becomes different. Now, in terms of what we expect from the Trump administration on his sort of a new executive order that's sort of in the works, I think we should definitely expect a much carefully crafted executive order that will take into account the recent decisions by the Ninth Circuit. Something else to sort of put our current conversation into perspective. While the previous administrations have taken a variety of different actions on immigration, what sort of made Trump's executive order stand out is that whereas previous administrations' actions mostly focus on easing the restrictiveness of enforcement on various illegal populations, Trump's sort of was the opposite, right? If anything, it made immigration even harder for people that is seeking asylum, for instance, in the United States.
And speaking of the impact on residents here, Mr. Estrada is an attorney here. You see that whatever the executive order that comes from the White House is obviously going to have a major impact on residents here that you see as clients and your colleagues at the law firm see and other attorneys in Northwest Indiana will see as well. But any thoughts on what you fear perhaps will happen or what will have to be addressed when the new executive order comes out?
So I think the Ninth Circuit gave some roadmaps of how Trump could do a better job in drafting executive orders and implementing them. Maybe training Border Patrol may be a good idea. But The Trump executive orders, I think, are overreaching and overly broad in a way that they just don't affect undocumented immigrants. They did affect those who had legal status, LPRs, legal permanent residents, visa holders, and DACA recipients as well. So, and that's not just the ban. The second one affecting, reprioritizing who's removable affects those with legal status here as well. So that's, I think, an over even more important issue than a ban. The Ninth Circuit said, hey, well, they granted to the injunction, and then the stay on the injunction was denied just because the government didn't meet its burden on the likelihood of success on appeal. It didn't touch the merits of disparate treatment on religion or the due process issues. So that's still to be seen. I think there's a roadmap in how the executive order could be better drafted, as you said, from the Ninth Circuit. But it's still, we'll still see what he comes up with in regards to Fifth Amendment due process issues, whether the countries he's included based upon high numbers of Muslims within those countries are included, and things of that nature. We have a big amount of diversity within the region of all different religions, and that ban touched. And we, all individuals have a Fifth Amendment right to due process. So okay. We'll see how it goes.
Frank, do you have something you want to add?
I think certainly with the first order, even within the Trump administration, there were certain departments that you probably that if you're going to draft an order, you would probably consult more directly with, say, the Department of Justice, who would be prosecuting this, or the Department of Homeland Security, who would be providing guidance to border officials and other ICE employees about how to carry out the priorities. And I think any sort of future order to replace the prior ones, either the travel ban or a supplementary immigration order, would provide much more direct guidance and may come maybe not directly from the president's desk as an executive order, but maybe a memo from these other departments, giving direction, which is ultimately more important, direction to most of these employees who are going to have to carry it out, and directions to Department of Justice, law enforcement agents, directions about how to work with or to try to work with state and local law enforcement officials to set the priorities that ultimately the executive branch has broad prerogative.
Let's, if we can, get our members of the audience involved in the conversation here. Our conversation here with Professors Frank Gallucci and Professor Yuo Yang, as well as Attorney Alfredo Estrada here at the Room with a View. And we have an audience that's been very interested in listening very attentively to what's been said. And Wes, if you will help us, if there anyone would like to ask a question of the panel, and we'd certainly like to bring you into the conversation now too.
Raise your hand. We'll get a microphone too.
My name is Jordan Sweet, and personally, I believe there's an issue, I believe it was Professor Ouyang that touched upon the law enforcement aspects. Are we concerned about the long-term ramifications that will be had on law enforcement? President Trump has ordered an increase on officers relating to Border Patrol and the various fields while freezing various other government agencies. Are we concerned that in times where already police power is being questioned significantly, this increase is not going to affect race relations and general relations with the law enforcement community?
Yeah, so I practice in immigration law, but my other portion of my practice is representing municipal entities like police departments, defense work against constitutional claims, use of force claims, policy and practice claims like that. So what Trump did in his second executive order was attempt to deputize local and state officials as immigration officers of those local and state entities that are willing to do so. We've seen it in border states, but now this is nationwide. I think one issue you're going to see reluctance and acceptance by those entities is the fact that the federal government is not giving any funds to do that. The statute that they cite to, INA 285G, requires that proper training be given to these entities to be compliant with federal statutes and laws on how to conduct themselves as immigration officers. So although it's an attempt to kind of increase law enforcement with the use of local officials, I see some practical issues in implementation. County jails, city jails are overcrowded at times, and without any increased funding, I don't see too many of these entities saying, yeah, we'll detain them, you know, and feed them and give them medical care as required by the Constitution once they're in their holding. So as for race relations, maybe Frank or you could speak on that.
I think one issue certainly that we saw, even with the early invocation or the early enforcement of the travel ban, which came out on a Friday, I believe, and there was enforcement over the weekend, is that when you write something, it's one thing when Congress writes a very broad law and leaves it to the executive to enforce. It's another thing and very problematic when an executive wants enforcement doesn't provide precise guidance for people or training or advance notice for people about how to carry out that order. And that's why you had almost, basically that weekend, you almost had border officials more or less being told to do something but giving no guidance about how to do it. And that's why I think certainly later executive orders would probably be vetted much more closely and given at least a little bit more advance notice just for the reality of being able to enforce them in a sensible manner and maybe to avoid some of the considerations about either discrimination based on race or other matters, that when you don't give guidance, when you give almost unbridled discretion and unbridled responsibility but without giving that guidance, then that's when those issues can most easily come up.
You bring up a good point here about having more of the president saying he wants to have more people actually doing the enforcement, more officers, and you bring up the question about how these people can be trained so quickly. The president's talking about having tens of thousands, I guess, more officers working for ICE can the agency handle. Not only the training, but handle all those people. That's an extra bureaucratic layer that has to be worked through, doesn't it?
Yeah, undoubtedly, ICE and the DHS, immigration courts are overburdened and overcrowded. I mean, I practice in an immigration court, and there is long delays in a master hearing. There's long delays in individual hearings. But I guess the question then is, how do we properly do it rather than how do we just do it? So especially when within his order, the executive order allocates no funds to any of this. And so that's the practical issue. Who's going to put the buck? And eventually, if they do find resources to pay for this, it's at the expense of taxpayers, right? So,
we have any other questions? We have one back in the back. Good.
Actually, two questions, if I can. First, just speaking of ICE, we hear on the news some reports of families being torn apart or whatever. Anything happening in the region in terms of stepped up ICE enforcement? Anything that you're seeing in the area specifically related to that? Second, in more historical context, you talk about it being a region of immigrants and wholeheartedly agree. Is there a lot of us would, of families who have been here for a while, would associate around the turn of the last century and the immigrations from Eastern Europe and the like. Is there any way to understand the level of undocumented immigrants today versus, say, the turn of the last century, when there was a big influx of immigrants? And were we, in fact, looking at and dealing with the same types of issues, and we've just forgotten about it, which is kind of convenient to do in today's society?
As for ICE pickups, I know there was a few out towards the South Bend area that made some headlines, some in Illinois. Nothing here particularly in the region. I've fielded some calls about potential. I do some work with Catholic Charities in their immigration clinic, and they gave some calls to me about some rumors about ICE in Hammond at Walmart, things of that nature, but it turns out to be rumors and people are scared for that. So nothing particularly that I heard of. There are always priorities of removal, and ICE investigates those. One of the easiest ways ICE gets detainees is requesting a holding of or notifying a local jail of a particular person they want upon a criminal conviction and release. So ICE will be there for them to pick up. So, but no particular raids have been made that I'm aware of. So.
I think there actually was someone from Hammond, in fact, in the news reporting of the raids just about a week or so back, that was conducted in the Chicago area. And I think it was a local newspaper that noted that there was actually one person from Hammond that was caught up as part of that ICE raid, but details were kind of sketchy about, you know, exactly what happened. And
I think that what the issue is, there aren't any increase in raids. What there are particular investigations where people are being, there's people they have particular, they want to pick up, and they go and attempt to pick them up and detain them. If there are undocumented people, and that's the change in just enforcement, if there are other undocumented people along with them, their undocumented status will now is a reason for them to be taken with them. Whereas before, there was almost a nonverbal agreement that we get that one person and leave. So I'm not familiar with that one case, but there was another part of your question I forgot. And, I think what difference is the tone we treat immigrants now, and in my mind, and who the immigrants are from, and maybe political thoughts about almost scapegoating of immigrants today. I'm not sure. I couldn't particularly answer that. Maybe Dr.
Maybe Kalugi. Historically, I know there have been, particularly turn of the last century, much of the political dispute has been on people coming to this country from other countries, whether it's from Southern and Eastern Europe or whether it's from Ireland. If we go back in the 19th century, political debates, even like the Lincoln-Douglas debate. So we've had, over American history, there have been, and the documentation then, for many of them, was sketchy at best, even into this century. Although, do keep in mind, from 1925 to 1965, U.S. had a very restrictive immigration policy, as opposed to a much more open, de facto open policy that it had for most of its history. And so I think it's not entirely different from the past, but we can see why the door was closed in the 1920s, and maybe we get some of those similar feelings in the country as a whole, that the new immigrants are different than we are. They may speak a different language, they may have a different religion, they may have different backgrounds than people who've been here for a long time, or they're threatening people's jobs, or those are calls that we've seen all throughout American history.
What independent financial resources can you utilize or create in your own district that could offset the federal budget cuts that are being opposed now by the current administration? And will you create a campaign?
Is that directed at me?
Yeah.
Could you repeat the question? I'm sorry. Yeah.
What independent financial resources can you utilize or create within your own district to offset federal budget cuts that are being imposed by the current administration that's within our state?
As particular to what? What are the budget cuts are you referring to? I'm sorry.
Say, like, if the current administration doesn't want you to have sanctuary cities.
Okay.
So they start cutting your budget.
So that was
Is there any way you could utilize your own financial resource or create a new financial resource to offset that?
Yeah, so the executive order imposed a penalty upon sanctuary cities, cities who passed resolution ordinances who said we will not cooperate with the removal of undocumented or documented immigrants. But, you know, that's already been litigated, and the withdrawal of funds has to be tied to the purpose of the law. So it was in connection, I believe, to either the Obamacare litigation or some other litigation where you can't remove funds, federal funds, for that are tied to roads because of immigration policy. They're not correct. They're connected in a way. It's unconstitutional. So it hasn't happened yet. And if they do impose that penalty upon a sanctuary city, I imagine they would do that with that in mind. As for independent resources, that's going to be up to the municipality upon passing the sanctuary resolution ordinance. And there's some activists going around today and recently visiting cities like Valparaiso and asking them to pass sanctuary city ordinances. So that will be up to them to kind of replace those funds if they have any that are taken away.
Hello, I had a question more generally about executive orders. Does an executive order allow the president to act unilaterally and simply bypass Congress, or must the executive order be written within the bounds of other laws?
So, yes and no, right? So we typically nowadays we typically hear of executive orders when they become somewhat controversial, right? In theory, the president do and can use these type of unilateral directives as an end run around Congress. And for some executive orders, that's all the presidents themselves will ever cite. So for instance, presidents may only, in the executive orders themselves, may only cite that by the authority vested in him by the Constitution, so by the vesting clause of the Constitution, he will now issue this particular executive orders. On the other hand, there are other, most executive orders does have a basis, or at least claims to have a basis in legislations or laws passed by Congress, and those get specified in the executive orders as well. The question now is, comes from an enforcement or implementation perspective, right? Just because an executive order mentions specific passages or pieces of legislation on which it's based does not mean that it's constitutional, right? The Trump's executive order, to take an example, that was struck down by the Ninth Circuit, is a case where it actually cites pieces from the INA and claims that it derives authority from there, but as we see, that's no guarantee for the court agreeing with it.
That's an issue the Trump administration had to deal with when they argued in front of the Ninth Circuit whether their executive order was even reviewable by the court. So there's a discussion on that.
Another question here?
There's been a lot of talk between the conservatives and liberals. So liberals are saying that, because I've been reading a lot up on immigration and various things, and I guess in Japan they have one of the lowest crime rates because they are not taking in immigrants. So there's this argument on the liberal side of it. They're saying that America is diverse and we should support immigration and let immigrants in. But now conservatives are saying now the immigration crisis we have currently, basically immigrants are non-assimilating people and they don't want to assimilate, and that's going to cause more crime. So I just kind of wanted some thoughts on this, because I don't particularly agree with that. But I just thought it was interesting that they would compare it to a different country, but America is, as you would see, it would be a lot different than Japan or anywhere else in the world. So I don't know if necessarily not allowing immigrants would increase or decrease crime. So I just wanted some thoughts on that.
think that's you, Ewan.
So I think you're right. I think it's somewhat not fair to compare immigration laws in the United States versus immigration laws elsewhere, even Japan. What you describe on assimilation, I think, goes not just to discussions on crime, but also discussions on and concerns that people have on immigrants themselves, right? Oftentimes in our nation's history, concerns with immigration and increased immigration often come at the same time as concerns with that these immigrants, or at least the perception that these immigrants come in and they do not assimilate into the American culture and or become Americans, right? Now, whether, you know, to what extent that's the case is, I think, is debatable, but that's always been a concern that people who speaks out against immigration have.
If I could just add one thing to that, I think it's probably fair to say that immigration is not purely a conservative liberal issue. There are a lot of conservatives who actually are in favor, for economic and for other reasons, of having something closer to open borders, both for both employment purposes and for movement of goods as well. On the other hand, there are some groups, particularly maybe who may have identified or voted with liberals in the past, who have concerns about jobs and employment opportunities in this country. So I would not necessarily say tie immigration stance to ideological issues, because there are for job purposes and other purposes, there are the reason that this is sort of a cross-cutting issue, and that's probably the explanation why Congress hasn't gotten together and passed a comprehensive or something comprehensive law in so long, because there are cross-cutting cleavages within each party and within different ideologies which have different views of the priorities of immigration or what sort of immigration we should prioritize and whether we should have it at all.
Any more questions?
Yeah.
Thank you.
As individuals who have not received permission to enter the United States, I was wondering what the legal status of undocumented immigrants is and what protections are afforded to them by current laws in the United States.
So, undocumented are protected. There's different reasons for people to be inadmissible for certain visas. And then there's those who enter without inspection, which is kind of the boogeyman of the country, right? These.
Is that what most people think of when they hear undocumented?
I would say yes, right? Those who come across the border without any inspection, but there are those who overstay visas, come here on tourist visas, business visas, and just decide to stay. So the legal protections that come with it are due process. So even an undocumented person has due process rights within immigration courts. They're entitled to a hearing before removal. They're entitled to have legal counsel at their expense. And there's certain defenses that they could raise within immigration proceedings, which could be a valid petition to the USCIS. There is procedural rights they have. And by all means, there are pathways to legal status even for undocumented, even for those who enter without inspection, those who stay after overstaying their visas. So that's the job of an immigration attorney to find those. There's special statutes like 245I that recognize the long wait of Mexico, China, Vietnam. The high importing countries of immigrants that allow for those who filed a petition before 2001, maybe they were a young kid and had a LPR family relative over here, but at the age of 18 still did not have their petition reviewed because the line for Mexico immigrants is 25, 27 years long. That recognize that troubling aspect of immigration law. So there's many avenues for undocumented to get to legal status here. So,
okay. Question back there. Thank you.
Yes. What is the legal status of cities and towns for sanctuary cities in the state of Indiana?
The Indiana State Legislature has passed a law to make it illegal for cities and towns to pass ordinances as sanctuary cities. So that's the status.
And I guess the follow-up with that then is, what can we do to work within those guidelines but still do some things that are proactive to support people in that status, maybe such as the welcoming city concept or something?
So I guess the question really is directed to what penalties are there for those within Indiana who pass ordinances and resolutions for sanctuary cities and whether the state has the right to impose those. I guess as an activist or someone involved in community, you still pressure your town councils, your city councils, to respect undocumented people. There was a great movement within Gary against the GL detention center that was victorious, and it was before that it was in Hobart. And it'll revisit itself here soon. So stay active. I think another thing that's been touched upon by both Dr. Colucci and Dr. Oyang, is that, the issue of immigration law presently is because of the lack of congressional, lack of any involvement by Congress. There's been polarization on each side to do anything. Therefore, the president has resulted to executive orders to try to implement immigration law. So stay active, make phone calls, protest.
Another question? Thank you.
In the past, the United States Supreme Court has repeatedly recognized that people have a fundamental right to travel, for instance, in things like Ward v. Virginia and U.S. v. Wheeler. So with things like Trump's immigration ban and his executive order about deportation raids in sanctuary cities, do you see a constitutional legal conflict between the way his immigration policy is going and the past historical precedent?
Frank, you want me to get it?
The Ninth Circuit is—that was an issue before the Ninth Circuit, was the right to travel. Those, one of the arguments the state governments brought up was their through the universities, their teachers and students' right to travel into the United States, travel abroad, and then re-enter as a fundamental right. So the federal government failed in that aspect to show that they would be successful in appeal to that. So if the next executive order is drafted similarly, I'm sure there will be some litigation on it. What do you think, Frank?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the next order, if it's drafted with any attention at all to what the Ninth Circuit has done, is probably going to be limited much more and to recognize people who do have legal status in this country to have that legal status recognized. That was a major issue, particularly with at least the initial enforcement of the orders, where you have people who actually have visas or green cards who are entitled to be in this country and to move back were being denied being able to come back in this country. And when they got on their flight, they had perfectly fine legal status, and then were not, once they got off their flight, they're not allowed out of the airport. I think that's certainly a right to travel, maybe a right of U.S. citizens and people with U.S. status. I do not believe we would say that there's a right from someone from another country to travel here if they have no pre-existing U.S. status. I think that would be a more difficult.
Yeah, that's going to be the art that's going to have to be used by the administration, is since they do have broad discretion in immigration law, the federal government, I think, is to properly draft the executive order to not be so overly broad and to affect those with legal status. Dual citizenship was even an issue there. So, yeah.
And probably have to give more of a broader justification. If you're going to limit people from certain countries, you have to explain precisely why. Is there something wrong with how they process visas themselves that would lead you to think that you couldn't trust the people from that country? You would need a much stronger and more precise justification rather than a claim of unreviewable national security. And you'd have to recognize the legal claims of people who do have legal status under American law and their ability to travel and to return if they have that status.
Hello. So my question is more so about the debate that's going on between most Democrats and most Republicans So obviously this is a very emotional argument that comes in some ways can be from both sides. And Donald Trump's comments have made many people on the left maybe feel alienated or out of place with his remarks. And in response, many Democrats have come back with this maybe raw emotional argument. And I mean, I guess on both sides, there's been a lot of name calling and a lot of insult throwing. And do you think possibly on the other side, maybe Democrats with their raw emotion or their reactions towards maybe those in the Republican side who have very real concerns about border security, but may not be anywhere near as far right as Trump? Do you think maybe Democratic response could make them feel alienated for? Maybe concerns about safety that they didn't, they don't feel are being answered by either side, for that matter.
Well,
I was going to say I don't think that's a legal question. So,
well, I think you know passions and emotions are good, right? They're maybe not when you know we only rely on our passions and emotions, but. They are what gets us, makes us active and sort of do things that we're passionate for. Now, I think what we saw lately, not with immigration, but with the potential repeal and possibly replacement of Obamacare could be a good example of what you're seeing, right? Even in the protests that follow Trump's ban on Muslim ban executive orders, they're not those passions, if you will, have not reached the level of what Americans that are concerned with Obamacare's repeal have, and that may be one limitation to where you know reliance on just the passions of a fairly small group of people, mostly immigrants themselves. The second part is, it's not just about our passions and our emotions on topics like immigration. I think we need, if you really do care enough, passionate about this subject, you need to somehow carry that passion over into your representatives, into your senators, because that's where policies will ultimately be made, right? I think one of the things that the three of us here would agree on is that if Congress does not act and we only sort of let the executive dictate immigration policies in the United States, we will get what we're seeing right now, and that is when a new president comes in, especially from a different party, we get a pretty dramatic shift on immigration laws and enforcement.
One thing I guess I want to – we talked a little bit about historical background. One thing that is certainly weighing on here and I can is – that I think there's probably a broad support in the country for immigration reform along with border security. But I think neither side wants to give their side up first. I think one thing thinking back now 30 years ago, I guess the most major bipartisan immigration reform was in 1986 under the Reagan presidency, and that included an amnesty. And I think even a lot of people, Republicans Party generally supported that immigration reform then, but now looking back 30 years, they're saying we gave the amnesty, we did not get the border security. So they're holding out for the border security, and you certainly saw that in the Trump campaign. That's why you're talking about the wall first. But I think there may be a little bit of room. That said, I think both sides want their side addressed first before they will give anything to the other side. And that's not a recipe for compromise. But keep in mind, even through the George W. Bush administration, there was a push from the executive branch, even when Republicans had both houses of Congress, and even later, when these last 2 years, when there was Democrats in both houses of Congress, to try to get some sort of comprehensive immigration reform. And that's really where it fell apart, because people generally agree about these two priorities there, but which one should go first? Each side's going to say, we're not going to take our step until we actually see, all right, we'll give some legal status, but I want to see the wall, or I want to see a fence. Or, you know what, I can think about border security, but what about the people who are in the country now? And how you get around that actually requires some sort of both presidential and congressional leadership for compromise. And while there is a compromise there, it's at least right now, the political feelings in the country, the compromise is there. Whether enough people are willing to give up a little bit to get it, it hasn't happened in the last 20 years, and I'm a little skeptical about seeing that now.
Yeah, I think the most recent attempt was Bridge, which was the bipartisan attempt to codify DACA, and that failed. So, and I think it failed because of, you know, well, why do we codify this if I didn't get my wall? So we'll see. Emotions aside, we'll still see.
Another question in the back.
Yes, I think sometimes there's an issue that people pass over, and that's the fact that there's, you know, when you start talking about immigration, you know, there's the human cost, there's the social cost, and there's the economic cost of treating undocumented workers unfairly. And I think this is a big issue that needs to be addressed, because the number's got to be real big, because if you're going to deport 11 million people, it's not cheap. And it's not, and you're going to destroy your economy. And I guess a good example of that, when Alabama got the smart idea that they were going to have these stringent migrant worker laws in about 5 or 6 years ago, and what happened was nobody showed up, and they couldn't get anybody to fill the jobs, and $3 billion worth of food rotted in the fields. So, and like I said, it's a matter of treating people humanely and creating some kind of system to where people can get registered as temporary workers and treat them fairly and make them part of our community in a fair system with the immigration reform. So whatever that, and like I said, this number's got to be big if we shoot it out there and these people in Congress start looking at it, what the damage they're doing to the country and the people.
Well, one issue that seems quite prevalent to me is obviously immigration is a very touchy issue, and it has been strongly argued that President Trump has overstepped his boundaries from a constitutional standpoint. But I would like your opinions as to the ramifications for the Oval Office as it is perceived by the people. It seems like some of these wounds will never be healed from. How do you see the effects of the executive branch based on the actions that's been taken down the line?
Well, that's somewhat tricky, right? Because legitimacy of the branch itself, right, does not rely that much on any single action. Now, having said that, I think there is a danger here, especially from the human costs and the moral standpoint of what we're doing in terms of immigration and what we turn doing in terms of our national stance on refugees, for instance. I think there's certainly a damage, not just to the executive branch or the potential for damage, not just to the executive branch, but also to the United States and where we stand globally.
I think we have time for about one or two more questions.
I'll stay late, don't worry.
So, regards to DACA, Trump has said that he will show a big heart, but under his aides, they are, what I've read, that they are working on shutting the program down through the Justice Department and through the courts. Is there anything that he can do to, like, have deportation relief under the people who are under DACA?
I'm sorry. So you're asking if Trump could have what type of relief?
Like a deportation relief for the people who are under DACA.
Yes. Sense, you know, so it's important to realize that DACA didn't give legal status to DACA recipients. What it was a temporary work authorization and a prosecutorial discretion not to remove it, those individuals. So it in itself was deportation relief. It was just necessary. It was just a executive order that if this immigrant, because of its undocumented status, would not be prosecuted for removal. so he could, in sense of executive order, President Trump could remove that at any time. So He's promised not to do it, but his executive orders concerning the prioritizing the new priorities of removal do affect DACA recipients, okay, because if they commit a crime, have been charged with a crime, or have committed acts that may be deemed a crime, they're at risk there.
It's come up several times how comprehensive immigration reform, or change as I like to think of it, has been gridlocked in Congress. I was wondering what the most contentious sticking points are that are preventing a resolution from being passed.
My thought is, and I've been saying this for years, is this myth of comprehensive immigration reform. It's a myth in my mind. I think a better strategy would be implementing step-by-step decent immigration reform. If we wait for comprehensive immigration reform, we're going to be in the point that we are now for a long time, because we've been in this point for a long time. So for one sticking point, to get to that one, you got 10 to get by. So I don't think there's one. Frank, do you see one that ties it up?
I think that's the issue. I think there are enough people on different sides that I can't see what they would agree on. We actually did pass was it even the Clinton administration? Or no, it was in 2006 in the Bush administration. We passed a fence act, but never actually funded it, saying, yeah, we should have a fence, but we never actually provided any funding for that. Oh, we funded part of it, yes. So maybe the solution is to do it step by step, and to give somebody one step and one bill that they can say that this is a victory for us, and someone on the other side to give them a separate bill saying this is a victory for us too. Whether you would do it step by step or as part of one huge package, what we can see is the one huge package has not worked for 20 years.
One last question.
Right. Yes.
What if our senators are not being heard at their hearings? Where do we go? Like, because it seems like now we're constantly in a circle trying to fight this, and I wanted to get your perspective and opinion on it.
You mean what we can do if our senators are
What if our senators are not being heard at the hearings? They're deliberately being watered out.
Well,
and not wanting to be even listened to.
Well, I think
because there's rogue officials in that hold the office that do that intention, that don't want to listen to anything that anybody got to say unless it's for their own gain. What if our senators are not being heard?
Well, I mean, to some degree, if we'd be a little bit cynical about what motivates our elective officials and what drives their behavior, right? It's not just a matter not just on immigration, but on any legislation, right? It's not just a matter of one or two officials getting heard, right? It requires a critical mass,
yeah.
Right? And so you have to wonder where this critical mass is going to come from. And I think both Frank and Alfredo
they have been masked up already, and a lot of people supported it. Whatever, a bunch of senators got together, whatever, for certain issues like this, and they're not being heard. I'm talking like a whole bunch of senators coming together, and they're not being heard.
Well.
Because they're being watered out.
Well, I mean, if that's the case, then we have to think about a question that was brought up earlier on: is there one particular sticking point toward, say, comprehensive immigration reform? And I think, and I agree with what Frank said earlier about, you know, it's a matter of which side gets what they want first, right? There is a compromise that we can have, but it requires it requires our elective officials to willing to take less than what they've been promising their own constituents. And in that, right, I mean.
I would say it's certainly not going to happen with a president who has made that the sort of the centerpiece of his campaign. Now, in theory, I mean, maybe your best hope would be sort of almost like what the stereotypical Nixon goes to China scenario, where you get the wall and then you could get some sort of compromise after that. I mean, that for the next 2 years, that's probably the best hope. To give some sort of victory and then try to work out the practical considerations. In the end, however, it comes down to who you elect to office and what their priorities are. And elections do have consequences, maybe much more far-reaching than we may think when we go into the voting booth.
And on that note, we're going to have to leave it. Thank you, audience, for being with us for the great questions. Thank you very much, Frank Colucci and Professor Yuo Yang and Attorney Alfredo Estrada for being with us this evening to talk about the topic that's obviously not going to go away. It hasn't gone away, and this is just going to increase here in not only the days ahead, but probably the months and certainly the years ahead. Thank you very much for being with us as our panel tonight, and thank you very much, audience, for being with us today.
Thank you.